history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there, stories that need to be told. We certainly don't want them to go untold because we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Visalia, California, with a guy who spent the last 55 years here. He's going to turn 97 just before Christmas, World War II Navy veteran Mike Kalustian. You're not from the San Joaquin Valley here in California, though. You're from a different kind of climate. Where'd you grow up, Mike?
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Where it's cold.
Yeah. You know, we've had quite a few Armenian American veterans on this program, and so many of them had a life story just from their parents and what they went through that I think made it incredible that they were even here. Yeah. How much do you know about your own parents and how they escaped the Armenian genocide?
My dad was in World War One. My mother and her mother and her brother somehow escaped Turkey all the way somehow through to Marseille, France. And there she was invited by a relative to meet her husband. And they were married at an age where she never knew her husband, never knew him, never, except that he was from the same part of Turkey. My mother, by her uncle, Agopian, came all the way to South Milwaukee, where she resided, and her children.
So your father was in the U.S. Army in World War One.
Right, yeah.
So his family had immigrated earlier.
No, my dad, his folks got killed in the during the massacre in Turkey. My dad somehow got to America and joined the Army. And then after the war, my uncle introduced... Well, my mother was in an orphanage in Marseille somehow, and somehow Rolda invited his niece to come and meet my dad in New York. And there they got together and got married, and my mother was about maybe 12 years old at the time. My dad was working in a foundry at the time, and my mother was a mother and raised children. Her first child died, and then I was born. 3 years later, my sister was born. Then 4 years later, my brother Harry was born. And that was our story of the South Milwaukee going up.
So your mother was 13 when you were born.
Yeah.
And I'm just pressing back in here because this is so unlike what most of us are used to. Such an unusual situation. So your father, both of his parents were killed by the Ottoman Turks.
Right.
And your mother's parents also?
Yeah, except my mother. Her dad was killed by the genocide. My grandma somehow, with her son and daughter, migrated from Turkey to Marseille. In Marseille, France, my mother put in a orphanage, a suffer home. Mm-hmm. And there, I don't know how, an uncle introduced my mother to her husband-to-be. Never knew who he was. And they got married in New York and came to South Milwaukee, Wisconsin. There they grew up and had their children.
It's a pretty unusual and incredible story, isn't it?
Right. Well, in the little cemetery where she lived, she was Turkish-speaking and my dad was Armenian-speaking. So when they were in the orphanage, the home, my mother couldn't speak Turkish. She had to learn Armenian or she would get slapped in her hand. Don't talk Turkish. That's not good. Don't talk it. You talk Armenian. And so she got to learn Turkish through my dad. And then we had Armenian and we couldn't understand Turkish because we didn't know it at that time. Mm-hmm. But later in life, we got to learn the language.
How much of all of that did you understand as a young boy? Because that's a big deal there.
She would never explain the worst part about the war. She would just explain, no, that's no good. Don't talk. That's not good. Just listen to what I tell you. She never told us how my grandpa got killed, how they experienced from Turkey to France, Marseille.
And I don't want to overemphasize this, but, you know, to me, it seems almost miraculous that you exist because it's pretty unique that your mother, a young girl, was able to escape because a lot of girls in her circumstances did not escape.
Right.
Or they were taken by the Turks and made whatever.
See,
and your father, his parents are killed, and he gets here, and he earned his citizenship by serving in the Army in World War I.
Right.
What a story for you to be born into.
Right.
And while we're on that topic, because, you know, we hear on this program, we talk about World War II, and oftentimes that involves the Holocaust and what the Nazi regime did to its prisoners. But the issue of World War I and the Armenian genocide is still somehow debated and still denied by some people in the world.
Right.
How do you react to that when you catch wind of people saying, no, that didn't really happen?
Well, we have to fight the battle with them. We can't win the battle no matter what. They say, oh, no, that didn't happen. But I can tell it happened because my mother and her mother came all the way from Turkey and explained the massacre of how they survived. My mother got to Marseille, France, but a lot of relatives went to Syria, Iran. They're all dispersed. That's what they call diaspora, you know. They all went wherever. And my mother's home got to Marseille, France somehow and put her in a orphanage home.
Yeah. So you grew up with no grandparents.
Right.
And a mother who's still a child.
Yeah.
Really.
Right.
And this is during the Great Depression.
Right.
What do you remember about those early years in Milwaukee?
You know, we just grew up like we are. You know, we grew up as in it. We didn't have money. We didn't have money. We used to go up and down the alleys looking for stuff to sell to the junk man, you know. But we never did work anywhere in our industry like now. These kids get out of school, they can get a job right away. We didn't have anything. We didn't have any McDonald's or whatever. We had to go. And if you're older, you couldn't get a job because you were too young. So all we did was run on the going to Lake Michigan and swimming in the water and watching them. It's a fishing, whatever. Mm-hmm. We never did have any experience of working, making some money.
Do you remember having some ideas when you were a kid? Hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going
to
do?
Well, when I was in high school, my idea was to join the Navy. I don't know how, but I wanted to join the Navy. And the guy from the Navy Department came to my home and wanted my mother to approve my dad to go in before high school in 1942. My mother says, no, you're not taking my son until he gets from high school. I want to see him graduate. He's the only one that's going to graduate from high school. So I finished high school in 1942, and I went and tried to help my folks out by helping a little bit. Then finally I said, Ma, I want to go in the Navy. And that's what happened. I got into the Navy, got into Great Lakes, got on the, whatever they call it, boot camp. Mm-hmm. And then from there we went by our train to San Francisco. From Francisco, we got on a battleship, San Francisco to Hawaii. In Hawaii, we got our ship at Pearl Harbor, and that was it. Our young was from, like, say, 15 years old. We were just a gang of kids at home. We just got together neatly. We never fought. Never had like these Nesekers now doing, you know. We just, as a gang, we talked nicely with each other, except once in a while, the Polish guys and Armenian guys would get together and have a little fracas, but that was about it. Yeah. We never had guns, never had knives, no. We just fist fight, that was it.
Here in Visalia, throughout the San Joaquin Valley, people have become familiar with Armenian cuisine. Was there something your mother used to make, homemade Armenian food growing up?
Oh, yeah. My mother used to make, she had a rolling pin and dough. She would make dough, roll it out, and make this pinch real thin dough. She cut it in squares and take each dough with a little piece of meat, inside ground beef, put in the meat there and pinch it like a wing nut. That was hard, but it was a little bit old. And then she could make cheese puff. Same thing, you take the same dough, put Bob's cheese around, lift the other half of the other dough over and cut it out and fry it. But cheese and my baklava, like mad for me. That's back. And I didn't like it. She made lokum, that red candy looking thing.
Yeah.
Sunji, the Turkish delight.
Uh-huh.
She would make that. Whatever I wanted, she would make for me.
Grape leaves too?
Grape leaves. We used to suffer because grape leaves, you can't find in Wisconsin. You had to go in the wooded area and look for a place, and we got poison ivy and whatever, trying to find grape leaves. Here in California, you got ivories, tons of ivories. Oh.
So you got poison ivy trying to find grape leaves.
Oh, yeah, I got poison ivy. Bad. I hated that. Ma, I don't want to. No, come on, we got to get grape leaves. Go to Reishi, go to Kenosha, any wooded area, you look for grape leaves.
Never heard one like that. What was the high school you went to?
South Milwaukee High.
Did you play any sports there?
The only thing I played with was boxing. Uh-huh. I attended the boxing mix and learned how to box in the Navy. In high school and in the service, I had to box.
Well, you talked about wanting to go in the Navy and having to convince your parents. But before that, you know, something happened that I always like to ask about because it seems like everybody remembers December 7th, 1941.
Right.
So I'm guessing since your birthday is December 17th, you're just looking forward to turning 18.
Right.
And then something happened. So how did you find out about Pearl Harbor and what happened there?
Well, you know, it was a Sunday morning. I was on my way to Armenian Church. And by home, I stopped at, we had a place called the Cigar Store. It had four pool tables. So I went in there for a short time to see what was going on with the guys. And that's where it came over the radio. And that's where we knew that December 7th, the war was gone. And I said to my folks, oh, I want to go. She said, no, you're going to finish school. And that was my story about waiting to grit from 1942 until I got December.
Did that shock you at all that the Japanese attacked, that now America was at war, or did you kind of see it coming?
You know how young kids are. You know, it was, hey, so we'll go there, we'll kill them, you know, we'll go fight, you know. But now we weren't, I don't know if I had that kind of anger in there. I just know that it happened. I was on my way to church, and that was it.
And had your father ever told you anything about his service in World War One?
No.
You just knew that he'd been in the Army.
Well, you told me stories like they would put leggings on their feet, you know, left, right, you know, because they couldn't speak English, whatever. But they would put red for the red toe, left for the red, whatever. But he never really mentioned, he didn't go to France like the most of the guys. He just somehow got in the service at someplace in New York.
So you get done with high school, you go into the Navy. What were you expecting? Did you have an idea of what you thought it was going to be like?
Well, I didn't expect to be, I didn't want to be in the engine room, but I just wanted fun to be in there and fight the war. And I don't know, I shouldn't tell you this, I don't know how to swim.
Oh, really?
I can't swim for a dime. I've tried Lake Michigan, I couldn't fight. And our school didn't have a pool. You know, my schools have a swimming pool. We didn't have a swimming pool, so I let them learn. Lake Michigan was always ice cold, and I didn't want to swim in the cold water. So I never learned how to swim. That didn't worry me about joining the Navy in case I got sunk or whatever. You know, I just figured, I'll go. Yeah. I never.
Well, that's, you just answered the question I know everyone listening is asking in their minds. It's, why would you join the Navy if you don't know how to swim?
I never thought of it. I just joined the Navy because I liked it. And why I didn't want to go into war at all, I don't know. And at boot camp, you had to swim the pool to, you know, it was one of the muster, or you go and get training for swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just somehow told a friend of mine to swim the pool, because their school had a pool. Cuddy, Wisconsin, had a pool.
Mm-hmm.
So Leland smoked the pool, swam the pool for me, and said, go over there, you know, because first they told me, go over here, you're going to like swimming, because I jumped in the pool, and I went about 2 feet, and they had to pull me out, because I couldn't swim. I thought, dog feet, I couldn't do it. They said, over here. I said, I'm not going to go swim in the pool. I heard about what they do, high dives in the oil and this. So I told Leland to swim the pool and tell me to give him my name so I don't have to go to the pool. And that's how I got out of the...
So he swam, got out, and told him, I'm Mike Kalustian.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he had to do it again for himself?
Yeah.
It was that easy to pull the wool over their eyes,
oh,
huh?
Well, how many guys are in that pool jumping in a naked pool? I thought I could swim it, but boy, I tell you, from here, I don't know, 12 feet maybe, they pulled me out.
Were there any other challenges or obstacles in boot camp that you had to deal with?
No, that was other than the duties that we had. You know, like one job was cleaning the grease and stuff out of the sludge. What do you call those things? Traps.
Yeah,
clean that stinky thing. But most of them was okay. It was only 9 weeks of boot camp, and then from then we went on board ship. I took my couple years, whatever you get your rating for rating, and I go take my rating. I got up to first class of machinery, man.
Mm-hmm.
In 4 years. So I was happy. I didn't do, you know, like these guys would gamble and this and that. I wouldn't. I just read my book and magazines or whatever, and that was it.
You had your boot camp at Great Lakes.
In fact,
there's a picture of you, of your whole class that came through there. Yeah. We'll put that up at hometownheroesradio.com. Did you get to say goodbye to your family before you headed west?
No. We came together in Milwaukee, and then somehow they loaded us up, went the back door at the arcade where the headquarters for the Navy was. We went the back step onto a bus and went all the way to Great Lakes. My folks are still up there waiting for whatever was going to happen with me.
They never got to say goodbye to you?
No. They didn't see me except after boot camp when we had, I think we had maybe a couple of days a week or something, liberty, and that was the only other time.
I was just wondering with, you know, what you described about your mother and how she really didn't want you to go. Was there an emotional moment when you had to say goodbye to her before you were going to be heading overseas?
When we were leaving to go to, I was kind of sad. I was disappointed in my mother that I didn't really stay home and help protect the family, you know. I just went off into the, not thinking about taking my folks, and went, I just helped my dad out. I just went to the Navy, and after I got on the ship, I said, you know, maybe I should have stayed home.
He would spend the better part of the next 3 years a long, long way from home aboard the cruiser USS New Orleans. We'll explore some of that when we come back. Check out photos of Mike Kaloustian then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Mike Kaloustian, 96 years old, of Visalia, California, originally from South Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He joined the Navy at age 18 in 1942 and was 19 by the time he left Great Lakes Naval Training Station. Mike's parents had escaped the Armenian Genocide and made it to America during World War I, but teenage Mike had never been outside of the Midwest.
Went to San Francisco, and all these girls and strangers and whatever, you know, like San Francisco had all kinds of words. It was a different experience. We didn't want to stay in San Francisco.
No? The girls didn't like the bell-bottom trousers?
Yeah, for a couple of weeks we had it fun. A lot of the girls didn't like anybody but Navy's. Air Force or the Army, they didn't like them. They just wanted sailors. They wanted our hats. They would seal our hats right off the bat. Yeah.
And you didn't get your ship till you got to Hawaii, right?
Right.
So you sail under the Golden Gate heading out to Hawaii, and you still really don't know what kind of ship you're going to be on.
No. All we knew is we got on the Pennsylvania battleship and took us to Hawaii to Pearl Harbor. And there we were escorted on top of the ship and routed out to where we were going. What, you're going here, you're going there, you're going. The only guys they didn't want, they wanted radio men really bad. Anybody that could do a radio, they got good ratings. Others, like me, I didn't know a thing about.
So, Morse code wasn't your strong suit.
No,
huh?
Morse code was out.
Well, and you mentioned the Pennsylvania. So your ride from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor is the battleship Pennsylvania, which had been in Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked and was damaged there.
My ship was there, too, to New Orleans.
New Orleans, right.
Yeah.
I'm just curious on that because I'm just thinking of you.
Yeah.
You know, you're still a teenager, and you're going from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor. There's a lot of guys on that ship who've already experienced war.
Right.
Did they tell you guys any stories? Did you get a feel for what this might be like?
Well, a lot of the guys were telling me stories, but then I noticed that a lot of the guys had good ratings, like first class or second class, from drinking or whatever. They'd get busted down to a Pullman. So I would try to say, no, I can't go drink because I'm too young. I can't go in the bar. No. So all we did was walk around the streets looking for pineapple juice, whatever, going to the zoo, you know, just sightseeing around.
Mm-hmm. And what about Pearl Harbor itself? Because this is where the war started for America.
Yeah.
Did you see things there that were indicative of what had happened a year and a half earlier there?
The only thing I noticed was that the ship was there, the Arizona.
Yeah.
And other than that, the town itself was okay. People, I mean, there was just like, there was no disaster or anything. We didn't notice anything different other than going to Waikiki Beach.
So you ride over on a battleship, but now they're going to put you on a cruiser.
Cruiser.
Did you know what your ship had already been through when you came aboard?
I knew that it had lost its bow and was put together when we got to Honolulu. There was nothing wrong with it.
So this ship, the New Orleans, it had been at Pearl Harbor.
Right.
It's been through the Battle of Midway. And then in November 42, it's in the Battle of Tassafronga.
That's
right. And literally the whole bow gets blown off the ship.
Up to the bow, number two turret. That's 150 feet probably.
And you've seen all those pictures.
Yeah.
That's pretty jarring to look at, isn't it?
That's what scares you. You say, oh, my goodness. You know, way from down below, from the bow to number two, that's 150 feet. That's quite a few. Luckily, you know, most guys, all the doors are slammed closed there, so no watertight.
But you haven't experienced any of this before. I can't imagine it's that encouraging to know that kind of thing could happen and has happened to the very ship you're joining.
Right. See, we were two of the worst battles. I missed out just by a couple of months. Mm-hmm. But after Santis around Macon Island, Tarawa, and then go on and on and on, Guam, Saipan, Tinian, whatever, you know, the big things were after the Battle of the Philippines. Philippines and Leyte were the worst of all the battles we were involved with. The making the Okinawa with the smoke fine so that the airplane couldn't penetrate and see clouds. They couldn't see what ship we wanted to hit. And then the sailors, the pilots chased ships, aircraft carriers, so far during the Philippine battle that they ran out of fuel. And they all dunked wherever because they were so happy shooting all the Navy pilots down from Japan. They had forgot, and they had to dunk their ship. And that's the first of the war that the Navy majority altered to put on your battleship lights and pick up the strangers by survivor. They put on all the lights and saved all the sailors that they could possibly save from being dunked on their plane.
So you come aboard this cruiser. What did they tell you your job was?
They just lined us all up and said, okay, you guys go in the after room. I didn't know what the after room was. Okay, I went down the Dalton. I didn't know gauges. I didn't know valves. I didn't know how to open a closed open a closet, close a valve. I didn't know anything. I just, at Great Lakes, they didn't teach anything. So when you got on board the ship, you go down the hatch to the engine room, and there you see two great big steam turbines with throttles on them. And you wonder, what's going on? Well, the Navy on the bridge tells you what to do as far as speed. And then you learn the routes, not us so fast, but those that could open the throttles to get 20 miles, 30 miles, 40 miles up by opening certain valves so the steam turbines could. So we, that's what we learned. Where I learned how to look and open a valve, I wouldn't know. I'd be trying to turn the wrong way. I didn't know a thing.
You had to learn the hard way, huh?
Hard way, right.
And you said you're a machinist, mate. So what kinds of things would you do in the machine shop?
I wasn't actually in the machine shop like lathes and stuff. We were maintenance. We would patrol steam lines, engines, whatever equipment was broke, we would learn to repair them. Fix a steam line if it was broke, seamless scraping. We did maintenance work was what we really did. We were not a machinist, maintenance per se. There's how many machinists can you have on a ship? You know, there was two guys, a chief and a first class, and they would learn to run lathes and lathes. But we didn't have many experience of repairs on it.
And what about the other guys on the ship? Did you make some friends?
The only friends we made were the same in our engine mesh people. As a seaman, and we didn't know. The only crews we knew were the after engine room and forward engine room personnel, because we would rotate around. I didn't know any first class or boatswain mates, you know.
And if general quarters sounded, what did you have to do?
Well, number one, you have to demand who's in the engine room. If number one was down the engine room, you had to go. Because we have four parts of personnel. First, one, two, three, four. If one of the three is down in the engine room, number three would go down the engine with them. If it was battle was four, we would go down. And if those that were on leaded from the top, they would go and help unload cannons. We were in charge with 40 millimeters. We make a line and carry those heavy things to each guy up to the after engine room, up until after taft, the back end of the ship, to the room where the 40 millimeter, that's where we'd go.
So you had a relay of 40
right,
millimeter
right,
shells.
Right.
Yeah, I know there were some significant actions your ship had before you got aboard, but what about the first taste of combat for you when your ship's guns are actually firing or there's some action against the enemy? What's the first time that happened?
The first one was Tarawa and Mikan Island. The first time where we saw the fireworks and where we learned that the people that were loading the ammunition would fire and we would load also. But then they found out that half the personnel that were Marines that were going to land to Tarawa and Mikan Island, they couldn't make it because the rocky coral and stuff was around, so we couldn't get close enough for the guys to go across. So we had to wait for them to sink into water and try to swim to shore. And we would have fire with, we had 20 millimeters and 40 millimeter caliber. We would fire those little small things or 5-inch caliber with shell to help them. Otherwise, we were excited. If we were in the engine room, we couldn't see. But if we exclude to be at the other half, we could go up and kind of see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the blasting of the island from the cruiser, we were lucky enough not to like the Marines that would land and walk
yeah.
in the water and then get sunk before they even got to the land.
Which was a big, big issue in that battle.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where they learned that lesson.
Right.
So most of us have never experienced this. I'm just curious, when you're on that ship, whether you're passing ammunition or you're in the engine room, and all those guns are firing, where your cruiser is shelling one of these islands, what is that like? What does that sound like? What does that feel like?
All you could hear, if you're in the engine room, when the turret, number three was right near us, right above us. And so when those turrets went off, the noise would rock our ship, scared like, hey, what's going on? And all the debris from the shell, the powder and all this flag, and would come sailing down the exhaust onto our engine room and we would smell it. But we could hardly wait for it to be sound. So we go up and see what's going on.
Well, if you went up and you saw what was going on, what did you see?
We just saw the disaster. That's when you went. I wish you were a Marine at the time. Yeah, we wanted to see the war. We didn't know the Navy wasn't going to have anything like that. But then again, we're glad we could have been. I could have been dead and make an island.
If you guys are firing shells, they're going to be firing back at you.
Yeah, you know, like when they were still battling, we could go on top side, just lollygag, because we didn't have any control about any noise. The Marines and the Army, they were on the island killing everybody. We would find out that they had turrets, great big fortresses made out of concrete, and the Marine would hurry back to our ship. We would use our 5-inch cannons and try to blast, but, you know, they were underground, buried. They were mean. They were very, very vicious enemy. But the Marines had their flamethrowers, and it was disastrous. To be on the battle in Finland, that was different than my part.
But even on your ship, I read, I think it was, you guys were supporting some landings in Hollandia, New Guinea.
Yeah.
In April of 44, where one of your own American planes from the carrier Yorktown was having trouble, and it actually flew into the mast of your ship?
Yeah, it missed the aftermast.
It hit some of the gun mounts as it went into the sea, read that gas was spraying everywhere, and the plane exploded,
right.
And even one crew member from your ship was lost.
One, yeah, but most of them were, it was the after that got hit the mast and landed on the port side. After it hit the starboard side, it landed, and then it exploded. And part of it got hurt, the people that were there, but most of them were under battle, underground.
But that must have been a little alarming.
Right.
Something like that could happen.
You wonder, hey, what's going on, you know?
And you guys were all throughout the Marianas there as different raids are happening?
Yep. We hit Guam, Tinian, Saipan, and we went on to bigger battles. They needed aircraft landing for planes to land and hit battles closer to the enemy. And one of the battles in Okinawa, as we were fighting Okinawa, we got a message from headquarters saying that there was a squad of Marines on the other side of the island. They couldn't get off. They were swamped. They could either ocean or the Marines.
They were trapped or surrounded?
They were surrounded, right? So we had to go around the other side of the island and bring these guys onto our ship and then to their people. Some were mad, and we took care of those that were hurt, everything else.
Well, and even before that, you know, I wanted to ask you about this, because there probably hasn't been a battle like this since then. In October of 1944, the Battle of Leyte Gulf.
Yeah.
It's the last time that there's been a real battle line of ships lined up, firing their guns at the enemy.
Yeah.
And you guys were part of that.
Yep. Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
Well, we remember we could see the telling us over at the high cap what's going on. They were explaining how many planes and planes were being shot down, fire at. The pilots on the planes, they were shooting these guys on left and right, just blasting them out left and right. That's where they chased the planes, Japanese planes, so far that they could not come back. Their gasoline was already depleted. So they had to dunk wherever they were, that dunk onto the ship. And that's when we got permission from headquarters to open up your turret lights and try to pick up any sailors you could find.
So you guys actually did that?
Yeah, yeah.
Did that make you a little nervous to turn your lights on?
Yeah, because that's the first time they ever did that. And, you know, you got submarines, you know. Just like that stupid Indianapolis that got disappointed. To me, the Japanese should have stopped, got on the top side, and tried to help those Indianapolis sailors out, help them, instead of the disaster. If you ever want a story, read about the Indianapolis, how those guys... Oh.
Yeah, and we've had some of those guys on this show, and that's a ship just like you guys. That's your sister ship.
Yeah, right. It's an older. And then, we were with the Minneapolis, Indianapolis, New Orleans, but that's when I started feeling hammer about being a Navy and not knowing how to swim. When I read that ship, I cried. I couldn't believe what would happen to me if I was on that ship and I was in the water. These guys would beat me up because... You know, those that were weak, they would drop them off because there was nobody around. And if the ship is like a raft, it would almost sink. So they'd chase people off. Other people would think they'd see an island there. Off they went. And it was just disastrous.
So, back to the point you made. So this is the Battle of Leyte Gulf.
Right.
But these planes have exhausted their range. So you know there are naval aviators who need to be picked up. and they tell you, go ahead and put your lights on. And you brought up the Indianapolis story because in that case, Captain McVeigh wasn't zigzagging and had his lights on.
Right, yeah.
And later they blamed that for the sinking, even though he's been pardoned now.
But our battle with going to Lydia was, like I say, the Air Force, Marines, and Navy, they were chasing the planes so far that they were shooting them down left and right. They were so happy shooting, killing all these planes that they ran out of gasoline after so many. Well, there was not the way to get back, so they had a dunk into the water, and we were given permission to put on short lights and look up as we could pick up any.
And I also read, with regard to the Battle of Lady Gulf, that your task force, your ship, and three other cruisers like you, that you guys were credited with sinking a carrier and a destroyer of the Japanese.
Right, yeah.
So those are your ship's guns knocking them out.
Right.
And you spent part of that time passing ammunition?
Right. In that battle, one of the carriers, one of our carriers was the Ben Franklin. They got torpedoed and it was sinking, listening. So we had to go close enough to watch to see what was going to happen. If the men would stay on the ship or come off the ship and we'd go save them. But luckily, they didn't sink.
Yeah, the USS Franklin survived that kamikaze attack in the Battle of Lady Gulf. It came even closer to sinking 5 months later when two 550-pound bombs set it ablaze. But the Franklin made it through to the end of the war, and so did Mike Kaloustian and the USS New Orleans. We've got plenty more to cover, so don't go anywhere. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 96-year-old Navy veteran Mike Kaloustian of Visalia, California. Originally from South Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but for 3 years in the 1940s, his home was the cruiser USS New Orleans. He's one of the last surviving members of that crew and one of the last Navy vets who can still tell us about the Battle of Lady Gulf, regarded as the largest naval battle in history. It was unfolding 76 years ago this weekend in late October 1944. It's the last time the world has seen a true Navy battleship clash with battle lines set up and guns firing back and forth. It was the first time the Japanese had employed organized and synchronized kamikaze attacks. The New Orleans was one of 300 American ships involved. And I'm wondering for you, Mike, as somebody that's helping to pass ammunition for 40mm guns on the New Orleans, how exhausting, how nonstop was that, and what did you have to do?
In the big line, and we're loading, these things are heavy, and we're, these guys on the 40 millimeters wanted those shells because, you know, they can't fire. So the big line keeps going. Come on, you guys, push those, get those things up there. And they're heavy. They're loaded. There's four cases of four. That's 16 in a case that would have to, you have to load up to the after engine room.
Mm-hmm.
And you wanted to see what's going on because you hear the noise from the 40, pop, 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 you know. And you say, hey, they're going to hit us, you know.
And for those who aren't familiar, the 40 millimeter is an anti-aircraft gun.
Right, yeah.
So the job you're doing may make the difference with whether or not a kamikaze hits your ship.
Right, yeah.
So that's pretty important work.
Yeah. Our biggest danger was escorting the carrier. If there was a torpedo coming toward you, you were supposed to take that hit.
If you know that a submarine or torpedo bomber or whatever is targeting the carrier, the Enterprise, you guys are the sacrificial lamb that's supposed to turn your hull in front of it.
We're supposed to take the blow.
Yeah. In other words, you're expendable.
Right. Yeah.
Is that something where, again, I'm just asking because I wasn't there, I don't know, that Lady Gulf battle.
Yes.
When that's finally over, is that a big sense of relief or yeah, wow.
Yeah, because yeah. we had done how many ships were lost? I think that was one of the biggest battles we had, and most of those people were gone, either sunk them or whatever, bombed them, whatever, in the planes by the Navy chasing the enemy back to their country, shooting them down, you know, hearing all this noise and flare and stuff. You know, it scared you. You wonder, hey, what's going on here? There's so many ships. You look like there's ships all over the place, all kinds of stuff. Transports, carriers, whatever.
And you said something there. You said, I heard you use the word scared. Yeah. And I never want that to seem like a trite question. I know it's serious business, but were you scared? Were you concerned that you might not make it home?
Right, that time, yeah.
Is that something you thought about much, whether or not you'd survive?
Before, I didn't think about it, but now that boy, with all these worst battles going on, it scared me. So, hey, I may not make it, you know. Mm. And I said, oh, gee, thinking about home and what's going to happen if I don't go back.
You mentioned Okinawa.
Yeah.
You guys had to come to the rescue of some Marines who were cut off, surrounded.
Right.
You did that. And I'm guessing you were probably there quite a while at Okinawa.
We were there. We bombed that island for a while before it landed. We would channel in from a couple islands away from us, and we would go there, load up, go back, and we battled Okinawa for I don't know how long before the early Marines landed. And to me, it was Easter Sunday that the Marines landed on Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
We would go there and bomb. You know, how many bombs we bombed? Days and days we bombed. And still, when they went to land the Marines, they were under battle. They were hurt. There was all kinds of mines. I give credit to the Marines for a lot. You got to have guts to be in World War II or any war. You know.
Did you guys ever bring wounded Marines aboard your ship?
Yeah. We brought that Hank group. I don't know how many guys were hung up. We came around and got them. The medical helped them cure whatever damage they had. After a while, we loaded them onto the new cruise.
Did you have a sense that things were getting close to the end, that Japanese may surrender soon?
No, I didn't think about, hey, it's still going to be over with. No. In 45 August, when the war was over with, that was a nice relief. And then they found out that you could get discharged by the number of points. Then we found out if you send all those people, like the engine room or the cooks, you could not get discharged. Because who would run that ship if there was nobody on board with intelligence to run their ship? So our points were off. Still, you couldn't go. You had to stay on board the ship. So I had to stay on the ship for another year, going back and forth to Japan and patrolling the Yellow Sea between Korea and China. We knew then in Korea that the Third Imperial, that's where the next war is going to be. We just knew that from the instinct. The enemy would come out and say, you can't go. You got to go get, you know, go in China. Don't go on our side. We don't want you.
You could see it already in 46.
They would chase you out.
What was the hardest thing to deal with? Because you were on that ship for, 2.5 years?
43, 44, 45, 46, 4 years. The hardest part was when the war was over with, I can't go because our chief machinist mate, engine room, you got to learn how to stay on board and drive that ship. You got to have a cook to cook the food, the laundry. You know, life goes on still, even though.
You had the points, but they needed you to run the ship.
Even the war was over.
So that was the biggest challenge for you?
Yeah. That I had to stay longer.
Did you get much mail from home while you were on the ship?
No, we got very few mail. Only time we got called if a mail ship had food that came towards us, like for food or oil or whatever, they would have some mail care and they would give it to you. My first Christmas gift is 1944, so that's almost a year and a half before I got my presents. The cookies and everything were all crumbled. Mail was disordered, you know.
So you got a package from home and were kind of excited.
Yeah.
Until you opened it up?
Opened, there's nothing in there. All crumbled.
Did you eat the crumbs?
No.
You know, you bring that up, and I know Christmas time is always different for you because your birthday is only eight days before it. What's it like celebrating Christmas on a ship in the middle of a war?
Oh, I said, you know, hey, I'm going to have my birthday coming. Where's my presents? Where's my gift? What am I, you know, because I expected my birthday gift and the Christmas gift at the same time. I told my parents, I want two gifts, my birthday and my birthday. I didn't want just one for Christmas, you know.
Yeah.
I wanted both for my family and my kids. I wanted both gifts. And that was missing because you didn't have it. And the war would go by, you know, January, February. Well, then comes another war. And no mail, because sometimes mail would be hired by some ship. By the time they got to where you could get something free, you know, where it's safe to land your, bring your ship there, because just like fuel oil and whatever, we had to meet at around at a certain time to get your oil and food. And if you didn't have it or something came up, that was it. You were gone. You're missed. We'd be out so long that the flour that they made the bread with was full of maggots, bugs. The first couple of days, we didn't mind. You could pick them out. But after a while, they got so, there were so many, we would take and cover them up with oleo or jelly and just eat it.
Extra protein.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure there are a lot of things you had to get used to.
At home, I would make my mad, you know, to do that. You eat like that, you know.
Well, what was it like to come back home after all that time on ship?
Okay, when I finally got discharged from the Pacific, we had to go through the Panama Canal, which was very interesting. How up and down. Took a while to get through there. Then we went all the way around to New Orleans and docked there in downtown, and we let the servant come and see our ship with his name and everything.
Because you're on the ship to New Orleans, and you actually bring it back to New Orleans.
Right. We were right downtown. We made a couple of days' delivery. Then from there, we went to Philadelphia, gave the ship to Mattball people, and we got our crews to come to Great Lakes on the train. They listed all your whatever you wanted, any equipment or any aches or anything else. And like a young kid, you don't answer your problem like, oh, my teeth or my eyes. Or you're too young yet. You don't have any. So we never reported any report. Even Vito, myself, we never reported, oh, I got bad teeth or my eyes or my No. When we got discharged, came home, and after a while, when you go to Great Lakes and say, oh, I don't see it on the record. You didn't say this. You didn't say that.
So did you have some issues you would have written down in retrospect?
We could have. You know, like my teeth. We had a dentist on our ship. Not once did I get called to the dentist to see my teeth. We saw a barber shop. We'd get a haircut. That was a must. But to go to a dentist, no.
So you had some teeth problems when you got back?
Yeah, right. They said it's not on your record.
What about your hearing from being around all those guns all the time?
Well, I never reported. I should have, but I didn't. I should have done that because I could have got compensation, because for a couple of years I was in the Indian room, all the throttle and the blower would blow all the stuff down your ear and noise from the turret going off. Never reported that.
But I understand that the VA is about to give you some hearing aids?
Yeah.
For the first time?
Right.
You're going to get your first set of hearing aids just before your 97th birthday.
Right.
Okay. Well, I guess 75 years is long enough to wait.
Yeah, when the kids come home, I got the TV on. Turn it down. So finally they forced me to go to the VA and set up for a hearing aid. She was a very good girl that worked on my ears.
I'm sure there's a lot of people listening right now that can identify with those same kind of conversations, whether their parents are still living or not.
Yeah.
So you finally get back to Milwaukee.
Right.
What was it like to see your family again?
Oh, it was nice. Very nice to see all the people and walk around the town. It's not a big town. It's a little town. Just walk around and see, oh, this is where I used to play the pool table, you know, where I first went in there when the war started. It was still there.
Mm-hmm.
But the pool tables were gone. It was just a magazine store now, you know, whole racks of all kinds of magazines and stuff. There was no pool table anymore. But it was nice going up and down, go down the train. We had a train track that went right between the north side and south side, north side of town. So you could go to one theater on the train track side and one track on this side. You just walk around sightseeing, meeting people you knew, just enjoying, you know. They had a bubbler in front of a drugstore. You go and drink cold water. Remember the bubbler days?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a nice little town.
Was it challenging for you to get back to civilian life after being around all those Navy guys for those years?
Yeah. The most important thing was our conversation, our words. Our vigilation was terrible. Oh, we couldn't speak English without swearing. Oh, it was really bad. My mother would slap my mouth every time. I couldn't, it was just one of those things, I couldn't learn how not to say the bad words. But after a while, we got into the factory, and then we started, friends were getting married, little by little, friends were finding a girlfriend, getting married. And after a while, some guy came up to me. He was Armenian, married to a non-Armenian. Came to me and said, "Don't you know nice Armenian girl you could marry?" I said, "There's only one I like, you know." And my cousin calls her home in Racine. She was in South Milwaukee by her niece's house, you know, visiting. And so I called her, asked an appointment, made an appointment with Elsie to see her in Racine. There was an Armenian affair going on there next week. She said, "Okay, I'll meet you there." And that was it. I met her. We fell in love more. I got married in 53, had 54 and 56. Then we came to California. Life goes on.
How'd you end up here in Visalia?
My brother was here. He married an Armenian girl. She had visited Milwaukee to some friends. Well, Harry got to see her. He liked her. And when she went back, he went back and met her. She married him. Then she says, "Come out here, it's warmer. Yeah, nice out here." And so we locked up our family, went to Visalia, and that was it.
You know, there's a few other things that I'm thinking about. One, you gave our country more than 3 years in the Navy.
Yeah.
Did you take advantage of those GI Bill benefits and go to school?
I should have, but I didn't. If I had stayed in Milwaukee, they had Marquette University.
Yeah.
Oh, I should have. You know, it was free. All you do is, everything was free. Books, everything. No, I want to go. I want to work in the factory where I'm working. Yeah.
What kind of factory?
The Cyrus Army. They make the big excavating shovels that dig up dirt and stuff.
Great. Okay.
Yeah.
And then around these parts, you worked at a big hospital here in Visalia as an accountant?
Yeah.
I know it's not easy to always answer a question like this or see it, but those years for you from age 19 to 22, 23. Those are some pretty important years that you were wearing that uniform and serving on the USS New Orleans. How do you think that affected the rest of your life? How do you think your service in the Navy had an impact on the rest of your life?
Well, I think my brain should have been thinking better about being more accurate with yourself. You know, find something professional and do it. You know, grow up. Maybe you're a young man now. You're going to vote, this and that. And we just went around. We belonged to the 5250 Club, which was dumb. But none of us didn't want a gang of our gang. We did get our $50 every other guy would get with a check. So we'd use that to go drink and whatever. I should have matured. I should have went to Marquette like I should have, you know, because it was free. Nothing to do, and you could have got any trade you wanted, what experience you wanted.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but I know, you know, one thing a little more recently that you experienced 5 years ago, you and your son-in-law got to go with a bunch of other veterans and their guardians on an honor flight, Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C., to see the World War II Memorial.
Those others.
What was that like for you?
That was very exciting. I first time ever been to Washington, but to be all the beautiful countries with all these people on board that ship that were like me, an ex-veteran of whatever, and to go to Washington, D.C. and see all these beautiful places, it was very, very rewarding. Now, Bill took good care of me.
I'm sure he did. To be at that World War II Memorial, it's a pretty big place.
Yeah.
You know, there's a pillar that says California, where you live now. There's one that says Wisconsin, where you grew up.
Yeah.
There's the fountain there. There's the Atlantic and the Pacific. And then there's 4,000 gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't come home.
Right.
What did you think about when you were looking at that?
When I went there, my biggest thing that made me cry was when I saw the Korean mural with those Marines with their drained and draped. And when you're walking, you could look at a guy and he looks like he's looking at you. He's looking at, as you walk, he's looking at you, he's looking. Oh, it was, that's one of the murals, that was one of the worst ones. The Air Force, the Army, this was the worst of it. To me, it was the one that really touched my heart.
So at the Korean War Veterans Memorial, there's all, they call them the ghost soldiers
out there. Yeah.
And you're saying when you walked by, it seemed like the statue's eyes were following
you. Right. If you follow one guy, he'd follow you. It was one of those. To me, it was one of the worst murals that I saw that made tears to my eyes.
And when you say the worst, you mean the most haunting or stirring,
right,
emotional.
The most, yeah, they're all nice. They're all great. Yeah. But I'm telling you, the one that touched me the most was the Korean War.
And you had been off the coast of Korea at the end of World War II, but your brother fought in the Korean War.
Right, my brother fought the Korean War.
And, you know, and I bring up the gold stars at the World War II Memorial because a lot of the guys that I meet now know somebody. Maybe it was someone back home in South Milwaukee or someone you met in the Navy along the way. Did you know anyone who didn't make it home from the war, who's one of those 406,000 who died?
I had a few. Yeah, one was Charbonnerian, B-E-D-A-A-N, Charlie. He died in the Philippines. We grew up together as a buddy. He was about the same size as me and everything else. We enjoyed things together. But he went into the Philippines, and he got killed there. And to see their name on the gold plaque, it makes you wonder what's going on. Where was he? What happened? Why did he go away? Mm. Why did the war come? You wonder how many guys. The worst is when I keep bringing up the Navy, the war, the swimming. You know, you're dumb. What do you join the Navy for?
Yeah. When you read about ships like the Indianapolis, yeah, or others that were sunk, and you would have been in the water.
Yeah, I would have been gone, you know, because I can't swim, and I was little, you know. Those guys were beating up people left and right to save their, you know, and guys were going off like, oh, I see an island or whatever, off they would go into. It was sad.
Awful. And yeah, the sharks, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I say, you know, Mike, you were lucky, you know, your ship. Could have been. We could have been picked for the Indianapolis because they're a little older than us. See, the Indianapolis is an older ship. So yeah, they were picked him.
They were picked because they were fast and they also happened to be at Mare Island at the right time.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but I do want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us your story. When you look back on almost 97 years now, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Well, I'm proud of joining the Navy and having God save me from disaster and come and be a wonderful, thankful American citizen. I fought in the war for my country. I love my country for now and now. I can see it now. People are honoring the World War II veterans. If you see a flag or a hat, honor, thank you, I'll buy your meal, or I'll do the, you know, they're all thankful. They're all thankful that you did your part, your share. We're proud of you. Thank you, buddy. I've had people from older people to younger kids buy me, thank you, and pay for my meal that I didn't know. When I really leave, it's been paid. So then when you say, hey, they're proud that they still live in this country.
And I would guess that most, if not all, of you listening right now can identify with those sentiments. Mike Kalustian of Visalia, California. He'll turn 97 8 days before Christmas. Check out the photos and a short video with Mike at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.